Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, along with Jim Petrosky and Kirsten
Giffen.
Hey,
it's me. You're back.
And Jim's back from the Heart Conference, where he was doing, you know, heart-related things.
I mean, that's hardened electronics and radiation technologies, folks. I was not at a medical conference, and I didn't get in a bathtub and swill wine in the top penthouse like the GSA people did.
But you are a heart expert, aren't you? I mean, you're one of the top heart experts in the country if you really want to know
That's
the
right.
truth. So, yeah.
Just don't go under the knife with me.
Hard with a heart.
So we had a great article that Miles, you wrote recently that sort of spurred a discussion amongst us. And he wrote this article in the Washington Times. It was called The Dangerous Myth of U.S.-China Cold War Tensions. And, you know, Miles essentially says, hey, the U.S. and China are not in a Cold War, and they have not been in a Cold War, because we do know what a Cold War was like with the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and what we are with China is nothing like that. So stop calling it Cold War II or anything like that. And then he explains in detail, in a very rational and succinct way, why they're very, very different. And so, and you know, I found his sort of argument was pretty compelling, and I thought, you know, we could have a discussion about that and some of the dangers, because you, Curtis, have argued that we have to stop trading with China, because, you know, when you do have an adversary, one of the things you don't do is you don't allow millions of their students to come to your country, which has the best higher education system in the world, and train to be, you know, scientists and engineers at these best universities, and then work in your industries to then pilfer your intellectual property and, you know, to potentially be sleeper agents and other things like that. So, you know, that was one of the many differences between U.S. Soviet Union Cold War versus what we have with the Chinese. And, you know, the Soviets tried desperately to steal intellectual property, right? They made a TV show out of it. It was called The Americans. It was a great TV show, all six seasons. I watched it every week. And then, of course, what we have with the Chinese today is, you know, the Chinese are embedded in our corporations and our weapons labs and everywhere else. And so the success of stealing intellectual property hasn't required quite the same amount of effort as you saw in the Americans when the Soviets were doing it. And so that's just one of the many differences. But, you know, Miles Yu talks about a lot of different things. So I thought we would sort of, you know, have this discussion. And what, you know, kind of one of my big questions is, what are we and what's going to happen? Is, you know, is Trump, is Trump's tariffs and other policies driving us to sort of cut these really close ties with the Chinese that we've had, or will we, you know, sort of have a spat and then come back together? What sort of, where are we and where are we going? And this is a great article to sort of push that kind of a conversation. So let me turn it over to you first, Curtis, because, you know, this was an article you saw first and said, hey, this is a great one. So what was it that sort of got your attention and you thought was worthwhile?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. I'll tell you, I was really impressed with this article. I thought Miles did a great job capturing this, although I would have added a little something extra to his title, which is which would have been, you know, the dangerous myth of the U.S.-China Cold War tensions. But perhaps we should be in a Cold War with them, you know, or should identify ourselves as being. And I think the point is that if you can accept that you might be that you're in a Cold War with an adversary, then you're going to focus accordingly. And I'm not sure that, you know, we've been calling China the pacing threat. all through the Biden administration. The Chinese threat was identified clearly in the first Trump administration, and here we are continuing to identify. And yet, this is really the first time that we're really starting, I think, to take this thing seriously. And I think what it really comes down to, the first thing, you know, besides the ideological fight that, say, between Russia and the USSR, this ideal between capitalism and communism, that might actually still somewhat prevail in this quote-unquote Chinese Cold War. But it's a different kind of capitalism, or I'm sorry, a different kind of communism, right? Over there, it's this sort of, there's a term for it out there that is slipping my mind at the moment, but it's sort of this socialist capitalism sort of hybrid. But what it's produced for us here, I just want to go over just a couple numbers here. So, you know, currently in 2024, America had a $295 billion trade deficit with its pacing threat, China. And that was out of a total of $582 billion worth of trade in 2024. That's about a one-third, two-thirds imbalance. And that in their favor. And that's pretty difficult war to win when all of that capital is going over there. And that $295 billion trade deficit that we had in 2024 is actually a pretty good one. In all through 2019, at least from 2019 to 2022, that trade deficit was well over 300. And in fact, in 2018, it was at over $400 billion in trade deficit. So this is a tremendous drain of American capital going to the adversary to build their military systems. Contrastly, in 1970, according to the CIA, the trade between the U.S. and the USSR was $100 million in 1970 money, which today would be about $780 million. Still, in comparison, a tiny, tiny amount. And again, most of that was grain and things that was really about humanitarian assistance. I think there was some oil technology so that they could, you know, pump better oil and whatnot. It was probably sold over there. Also, when we think about budgets, the Chinese defense budget has increased 7% annually year over year for at least the last decade. And that's a tremendous amount of money. And even though they report their defense budget to be about $300 billion American, last year, Senator Dan Sullivan from Alaska on the Senate floor said, hey, look, the American international community calculates, if you add in all the off-budget defense spending, it's closer to $700 billion. And at the time, the American defense budget was only about $180 billion more than that. And if you factor in purchase power parity, which is the real spending power of that $700 billion, that budget is really over $1 trillion. That's what we are feeding our adversary, not just from America, but from the West writ large, as they continue to trade with what Miles believes is the number one adversary, and I'm not sure I disagree.
It's hard to disagree with that because, you know, it was hard for the Soviet economy to grow, and it never reached more than about 25% of the U.S. economy. I think at one point it got closer to being half. But it never could keep pace. It could never grow anywhere close to what we were growing. Whereas we have, we've essentially put a turbocharger on the Chinese economy. And you know, when essentially Mao opened China by bringing Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon there, and then Deng Xiaoping said, you know, it doesn't matter what color a cat is as long as it catches mice, and then hide your strength and bide your time, and you know, made all these reforms and grew, and then now it's communism with Chinese characteristics, and they've built this system to where they can have essentially a freer market. It's certainly not a free market, but a freer market, but it's, you know, a population that's watched and you know, sort of controlled, but for the sake of growing and supporting the Chinese Communist Party. And we're enabling that. And we've enabled it with technology. We've never punished them for the theft. You know, it's, I think, what was the number? Somewhere between $30 and $40 trillion of intellectual property theft over the last couple of decades.
Oh, a trillion. Yes.
Trillion with a T.
Billion a year. Yeah.
And then, you know, companies that think, oh my gosh, the Chinese market's going to be this panacea where we'll now all of a sudden get rich. But in reality, it's, you know, there's got to be tech transfers. And if you look at, like, you know, this is one of the things Donald Trump's been talking about is, well, look at the actual tariffs on American goods. The Chinese economy is not built to buy American-made goods. It's meant to keep them out. It's meant to entice the companies in so that they'll then bring their production and manufacturing to China, build all these advanced items, you know, iPhones and whatever else there. We'll get the technology to then build all these advanced things. And then we'll, you know, we'll get the intellectual property. We'll, you know, we don't observe patent, you know, patents anyways. So we're just going to ignore it and steal it. And, you know, look at what China's been able to do. Look at companies that started out, you know, making very simple things and are now, you know, the world's largest cell phone company, you know, in a Chinese company. And so you have this, and what are we doing but enabling it? Correct. Jim?
Well, thank you. Yeah, before I begin, I told everyone in the show prep, and I fundamentally will disagree with Adam and Curtis in some pieces of this, but I was really happy as we started out this conversation that Adam agreed with me on the value of scientists and engineers, because he said China came, took our scientists and engineers and all that knowledge away. They didn't take our political science and none of our history major. They took none of that with them. They didn't take the people that built the defense travel system with them to go
well
corrupt
their
organization, but they did take the scientists and engineers, which gets him some kudos. So thank you, Adam. Okay, so so with that aside, and let's get back to the article. So, you know, I read this article and I started looking at a piece of this, and being a scientist, I said, well, first thing I need to do is understand, it says Cold War. Like, what is a Cold War? How is it defined? And so I looked all over the place for a Cold War, a non-country specific Cold War, and it doesn't exist. The only place I could find it, Britannica is probably place I found it. And it said the Cold War was an ongoing political rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union. So you take those two out of there. Ongoing political rivalry with the respective allies that developed after World War II. Okay, let's see. And then they read, I got to go down here further. Okay, it was characterized by political tension, military competition, ideological conflict between the capitalist Western Bloc and the communist Eastern Bloc. Okay, so to me, when you want to say we're not in a Cold War, I think you can argue that all of those in that definition apply. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to use the definition, at least as far as these experts have said, then I would agree that we probably are in a Cold War with China, but it's a different Cold War. And I think that's the piece that's missing here, is we're not in the same Cold War and we can't use the same strategies. In fact, the Russians had a completely different Cold War with us by simply trying to hold us off with military might and not being interacted with us. And I think the Chinese learned from this in the long game they're playing. I think the Chinese said, okay, we've seen what you did to Russia, and we are going to battle that by becoming economically entwined and almost to the point of being so economically entwined with the U.S. that you can't do anything, because we will deter that with our economic message. And we're seeing some of that right now. And the real question is not that are we in a Cold War or not in a Cold War, but how do we disentangle the global economy, or we entangle them, but it doesn't seem to be working very well. We disentangle ourselves from this global economy, and then what's the world look like after that? And I would say the second piece, because we know, and China has, in fact, stated they wish to be the global superpower. How do we stop that from occurring? What do we need to do to become in a position where we can say, we will stop you from being a global superpower. Maybe the first step is becoming at least equal rivals on the economic front before we're too far behind on the military front. And I think that's where we're headed. And it's interesting where we're heading, but it is, I will agree with the article, it is a dangerous time, because if you back them into a corner, they have a lot of military might right now and a lot of sort of strangleholds on the U.S. that need to be contended with. So from a deterrence standpoint, gentlemen, where do we go from here? Or just tell me you fundamentally disagree with me, except for the science and engineering part, because we all agreed on that up front. So, but on my assessment of whether it's a Cold War or not, I think it's a different Cold War. I mean, we're not shooting at each other yet, but I do think all of those pieces of a Cold War exist, but they're approaching it differently. Probably, in my view from China, they're approaching it fairly smartly from an economic standpoint, because we're capitalists and we understand money. Jens? Well,
let me just, before Adam jumps in here, let me just throw a couple of caveats to what you're saying, Jim, because I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, but I would say that this is a Cold War because it is also outfitted with tremendous amounts of espionage, like the old one, except now we have new ways of doing it. New forms of competition that didn't exist in those days. And the biggest thing that's different about this is our adversary arguably is richer than we are. Again, when you take into account purchase power parity, the Chinese economy is larger than the U.S. economy. And so what you have to understand is we're not dealing with, as Adam described, a USSR that barely could get to about half of what our GDP was. We are now in a position that, again, exchange rate, we are larger, but under purchase power parity, they are larger. And that economic struggle at the very tippy top of the pyramid is part of the challenge here. And that is why they can develop so many nuclear weapons in such a short amount of time, or build hundreds of ships in a year, and do all of these other things, because they can afford to do so.
With our money, by the way.
With our money. Yeah. And then they have the obviously the manpower, and now they have the technological skill, and I would argue they don't need to send their students here anymore. Their schools are every bit as capable. They are now, I think the term is a second generation developers of technology. Now they don't need to harvest from us to I mean, they lead us in hypersonics and other things and other areas of high tech, quantum computing, and so we are in the struggle to catch up here. And that's the other difference in this Cold War, is that we are the ones that are now having to race, not the other way around.
Yeah, I want to highlight a point, though, that an opportunity point here before it goes back to Adam, and that is that Russia, though, has always been able to have a smaller economy than us, and still be able to be a deterrent to us doing anything with them, and they use their nuclear weapons as that piece, so they gain their power that way, not through their military, I guess nuclear weapons are military, but they use their nuclear weapons as their way of deterring the U.S. Mm-hmm. They use them all the time. Now, China hasn't begun to do that, but maybe they're doing it behind the scenes. They certainly are showing us that they want to do that, show us that military power, and I don't disagree with you there, but I still think it's an economic war, and I think, who knows, it could be won as an economic war, and that's the fear I have. Adam, you're the economist here.
Well, it's interesting, because if you look at export dependency, and so, export dependency is really going to have an important impact on who tries to win or lose this economic conflict we may be in. So for the U.S., if you look at major players, the U.S., 11% of GDP is in exports. We are the least export dependent nation. Now, we're the world's largest importer, because we buy lots of stuff from lots of places, and we're the biggest, that's why we have these trade deficits, is because we don't export that much, but we import a ton. The second smallest export-dependent nation is China. Only 14% of their economy of the GDP is dependent upon exports. The countries for Japan, it's 18%. The two countries that are heavily, heavily export dependent, the number one most export dependent nation is South Korea at 38% of its economy. And number two is the European Union at 37%. So the U.S. is in a better position to, you know, engage in a trade war because largely most of what we make is consumed here in the United States. But China is actually not in the worst position either. But when it comes to China versus the U.S., they're more dependent on us purchasing their stuff than we are on, you know, them purchasing ours. So that's good for us. This is why the Europeans don't want to have a trade war with the U.S. is because they're heavily dependent upon Americans buying European products. That's why if you go to LinkedIn, there's all these, you know, I don't know what you call it, messages or whatever, telling Americans, how do you like your higher prices on your, you know, Gucci products and your Versace and all your European brands? Because, you know, they're saying, you know, tariffs are bad. But this for the U.S. and China, it's a different dynamic. And, you know, the other problem is they're also dependent on, you know, it was released today that Xi Jinping is cutting the U.S. off from, you know, critical minerals, that he's going to restrict those sales to the U.S. But for China, you know, they're the largest consumer of advanced microchips because they can assemble products with microchips, but they can't make advanced microchips. They don't have the capacity, and they can make, you know, older DDR stuff. They can, there's stuff they can make, but the advanced stuff is not what they've been able to do. That's where the Taiwanese, the South Koreans, the Japanese, they have the capacity, and, you know, we're trying to rebuild it here in the U.S., but the Chinese don't have it. So it's sort of a interesting dynamic of, you know, how will this play itself out and who's hurt more economically?
Yeah, Adam, I'd say the other thing, and I'm curious, since you study this, is I think about the Chinese markets, and I was just looking at them earlier today. You know, they say a lot of the tariffs are going to hurt us on Chinese toys. Now, if you cut me off from, you know, G.I. Joe and the Kung Fu Grip, I still think I can fight my war without, you know, the toys. And so, but I can't fight without food. I can't fight without, you know, military equipment. Now, China's been building that up rather quickly. That's sort of where we want it with, you know, sort of really put the clamp on Russia. But in the U.S., with U.S. and China, I don't see that. Now, you're right. We can get a lot of the other things like the minerals and such. Vietnam is, I think, a good player in this. But I'm curious, have you seen what that trade imbalance is on things that are what I'd call staples or, you know, services? I mean, we saw in pandemic, there were some things we've got to bring back to the U.S. That's where I think the trade war pays off for us, bringing it back home.
Yeah. You know, for example, I think, you know, Curtis has pointed this out, precursor chemicals to fentanyl, they come from China. If you look at pharmaceuticals, the number one producer of pharmaceuticals in the world, particularly to the United States, is China. And we're getting a lot in what's interesting is when it comes to opioids, a lot of the opioids that are produced in, you know, these pharmaceutical companies, they're produced in places like China where the FDA does not effectively regulate their manufacture. And so a lot of this opioid epidemic, set fentanyl aside, but the opioid epidemic that has, you know, sort of developed since the, you know, the creation of OxyContin has been in many respects, you know, sort of facilitated by the FDA's inability to effectively sort of ensure that the production of these drugs, and of course the overprescription of them, that's a different story, but they're not watched as they're produced in Chinese pharmaceutical companies that have, you know, contracts with American pharmaceutical developers. So this, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, if we look at, you know, the in electrical production, right? Your, you know, your components for our electrical, what am I missing, Jim? I'm drawing a blank. No. For electricity production. Transformers.
Generators. Yeah, they're far from overseas. Well,
those are
transformers.
Big robots
are
that change from cars. What are you talking about?
And they're multi-million dollar transformers. Mm-hmm. Are multi-million dollars. You order them years in advance.
Yes.
And you know, a lot of it's the materials made in China, and so you know we have all of these dependencies. But then, at the same time, the Chinese can't feed themselves. So. You know, it's how does this ultimately play out and how quickly can we reshore all of these things? Like, for example, I'm not that worried about, you know, like I'm a baseball fan. And for those that have watched this podcast on TV, you know, on YouTube, I oftentimes wear, you know, a baseball jersey and hat. Well, most of that stuff's all made in China. So I would potentially not buy, you know, Major League Baseball jerseys for a while until the Vietnamese or the Bangladeshis or, you know, maybe clothing manufacturer moves to Western Africa and you cut the supply chain. Who knows where it might move to, but it won't be the Chinese because of the trade war, you know, so, and, or toasters, where do toasters get made now? And all sorts of other components. Well, I've got a daughter who toasts a bagel every day. So toasters are always important to me. So, but there's lots of stuff that, you know, you can either shift the shoring of where it is and find new producers, or you bring it back to the U.S.
Well, let's all great stuff. And I want to bring this back to the Miles Yu article.
What article?
Because he says in here, he says, look, we must engage in a real Cold War. And that means drawing red lines and enforcing them. And I think that starts with economics, which I think we've really talked about here. But this gets to the other appetites that China has. Beyond, you know, this idea of peaceful coexistence, which the Russians, the Soviets always espoused, I'm not sure I get the same feeling from the CCP. And there's sort of this idea that that there's some sort of heavenly destiny hoisted upon them that they should be able to control. Things that they're not in control of now. And so we're going to have to figure out how we're going to deter those appetites when it comes to that. And I think it's, again, it starts with cutting off the money supply, because money runs on everything, runs everything. But then we've got to get firm on our desire for resolve. When we look at Taiwan, we had the commander of the Pacific Indo-Pacific Fleet, Indo-PACOM, I should say, Admiral, Pompeo, give his presentation, his testimony to the Senate a week or two ago, and he talked about China is rehearsing, was the term he used, not exercising, but rehearsing a blockade of Taiwan, and yet. You know, everybody's sort of thinking, well, what are we going to do to deter this war? And no one's answering that question. And so, you know, more forward presence is not necessarily enough. Maybe we should openly show the world that we're practicing how to run a blockade. You know, that we can defeat it. Because what we want to do is avoid whatever is going to happen here by, you know, some say by 2027, and be more proactive in our deterrence. I just don't see where we are as aggressive as we should be when it comes to averting this war. And I think Miles is on board with that. Am I missing something?
No, I see that. But there's another piece of this, I think, that is... it's got to be looked at. And again, I'll draw the parallel to nuclear weapons. If we were going to say tomorrow we need 100 more nuclear weapons, by the end of the day, we're going to have the same number we started the day with. Okay. And then the end of the next year, it's still going to be the same number that we started with, because it takes a while to build up that capability. The problem that I think we're in right now, and where I think military fills in, and this going back to my question, you know, what we do is economically, yeah, the tariffs are probably a start, but tariffs out there right now are not going to build a semiconductor plant in Ohio tomorrow. tomorrow and begin to take and peel that away. And other countries are not poised to do that either. And so there's this interim period that I think is this, to me, the frightening period where we need to have, you know, and I say we are at a Cold War, but we need to change the Cold War from a Russia-US concept to a Russia CCP or a US, yeah, Russia CCP, that'd be good. US CCP, but that you could actually, you know, begin to build that.
It's the collective. You got to plan against the collective now.
Yeah. And so we've got to figure that out as some piece. And there's going to be time before we can get ourselves back pre-positioned to be able to put off any upcoming or aggressive action. And I think that's the issue where, you know, what would you say, will be where if deterrence is going to fail, that's where it's going to fail. And that's the important piece for us to look at.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. I think Miles, you kind of sums it up. And since we're running out of time, I'll use his summation to sort of wrap us up. And, you know, he says the U.S. has handed the CCP a strategic gift, access to capital, technology, and markets without demanding adherence to reciprocal norms. The result? The CCP enriches itself by gaming the system through intellectual property theft, forced technology transfers, state-backed dumping, and widespread espionage masked as joint ventures. And we've really built an economic system that makes it hard for us to get to the Cold War that you know, Jim suggests we really need, and that I think Miles suggests and Curtis, and, you know, we would all probably agree we do need that Cold War. But I'm not sure that we're getting to that point where we continue. It's sort of like, you know, take natural gas and the war in Ukraine. So, you know, I think you pointed this out a few weeks back, Curtis, that the Europeans have purchased more natural gas from Russia than they've given monies to Ukraine to fight the Russians. And it's hard to help beat the Russians when you keep funding the Russian economy by buying their natural gas. So, you know, it's we are the other free nations of the world are guilty of supporting China's aggression because we keep funding their military buildup.
That's right.
By buying their stuff.
But wasn't the goal of the global economy that we'd all say, well, we're all dependent on each other, so kumbaya? I mean, wasn't that what we were sold in the 90s?
Well, but we've already seen, you know, that book was written in 1911, right? And that book, you know, was proven to be wrong.
Yep.
And, you know, we fought multiple world wars and, you know, trade didn't stop it.
That's right.
So I think, you know, we know that just doesn't work. And now it's, you know, it's time to move on from that view.
Before we wrap up, I will say that, you know, buying Russian oil was the one thing that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan disagreed on. And it was the start of this Western dependency on Eastern product, for lack of a better descriptor. And that has continued into the post-Cold War period, where we believed if we brought them along that they would pacify and become more like us. Instead, they've used every perk they've gained to make their desire to separate even more available. And so this has become that ultimate challenge, and so I think though that the fundamental question we are going to have to answer is to Jim's point here is that, you know, we know there's a problem, and a year from now we still won't have the factory that we need, but a year from now China will have another 100 warheads.
Yep.
Because the Intel community has told us in open source that it keeps rising by 100. We will have built how many pits in a year?
Well, we got one last year.
We got one. We're supposed to have 80 by the end of the decade, right? They're building 100 a year, presuming it's a new pit with each nuclear warhead. So this is what we're up against. And until we make it a priority, and I've said this over and over, if you call it a Cold War, it prioritizes the nation. It focuses the nation as to how you got to solve this problem. and it weans you off of the easy fixation and cheap labor, or whatever it is that is enticing of China, and you have to just realize that these are not, these are not the droids we were looking for, and it's time to move on. Unfortunately, and the only way we can do that is a little cold reality.
Cold
war reality, right?
I mean, it's going to be, I'll be honest with you, it'll be tough whenever, you know, I make my annual New Year's hike down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and back up, and there's nothing in the Grand Canyon gift shop when I get back up there. That's going to be tough, but it'll be worth it. It'll be worth it. So
I'm willing to sacrifice that for the good of the country.
Yes. Correct. All right. Well, gents, thanks for another great discussion. It was good to have you, Jim, and you, Curtis. And of course, we want to always thank our listeners. And, you know, if you go, Curtis and I did a podcast while Jim was out last week, and we had one of the listeners, he took issue with it and left us 17 comments. And we welcome your play by play. Yeah. We welcome your play by play. It's, that's part of what makes it interesting, and we read them and appreciate all those comments. So keep doing that. Send us email. Happy to chat, or we can disagree back and forth. Any of that's welcome as well. So, of course, thanks for listening. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.